you know, like people will tell the story as a victim or a survivor. I'm a survivor of all these things. Well, I was a survivor. I'd been a victim, but I was a survivor at that point. But to say I'm a survivor still means there's a story. You know, and at that point I realized, oh, this stuff happened, but I'm not any of these things. It's not part of me. It happened and it's gone now. And like right now, today, I'm not affected by the story of my own mind, you know, and it was kind of like I'd woken up from a bad dream and I was free.
Hello and welcome to the Finally Quit Porn podcast. First one in the studio today. Today we have Jason Shires on the show. Welcome on the show, Jason. How are you doing today?
Pretty good, thanks. Great to be here.
Yeah, thanks for coming on. Do you want to start by telling us a bit about your story, how you ended up getting into working in addiction and what you're doing now as well?
Yeah. Long story, how I got here, starting off at 5 years old, my dad was killed, getting into food addictions as a coping mechanism, and then into drugs and crime at a very young age, and finally into heroin when I was just a young teenager. Long story of chaos, psychiatric care, interventions, prisons, institutions, till I finally got clean when I was 23, which was 30 years ago this year. Then becoming a psychotherapist as a way of helping myself, you know, really, because after I put down drugs, I realised that what I call whack-a-mole addiction started, you know, because it was just stop one and start another, stop one and start another, and it was just really like whack-a-mole, exactly like that. And I couldn't work it out why I took the drugs out of my system and couldn't stop. So I ended up becoming a therapist thinking that, well, surely if I could understand other people, I'd be able to understand myself, you know. And that's been a long journey through all different psychological theories and spiritual traditions and different stuff to bring me to where I am today, I guess.
Yeah. And so what you were saying there about like whack-a-mole, so you'd stop one and then you'd go on to another. It sounds like you had some horrible things happen when you were younger, and so you'd start one addiction, and then were you working to get rid of that? How did that happen? How did you like kind of go from like food addiction, and then what addiction did you go into after that, I suppose?
Yeah, it was a long list. I mean, there was a time when I went to every anonymous fellowship there was, you know, Overeaters Anonymous, Sex and Love Addicts Anonymous, Sex Addicts Anonymous, Gamblers Anonymous, Narcotics Anonymous, all at the same time, thinking I had to deal with all these separate individual issues because I was an addict to all these things. But, you know, like, it makes sense. Like, as I see it today, it makes sense why you'd move from one addiction to another, because addiction is a coping mechanism. It's not a problem in and of itself. It is a symptom of a deeper issue. So if you take away the drugs and alcohol without providing a deeper or a further coping mechanism, i.e. emotional well-being of some type, which usually doesn't come straight away, especially if you've been addicted to drugs for 10 years, you're just left with yourself, which is quite often a gaping hole in the soul, a spiritual hole, a lot of pain, a lot of struggle, a lot of suffering. So the next thing that comes along that makes you feel good is the next thing that you do to excess, because it feels good and you're tired of feeling the mental anguish, activity, the emotional struggles and so on. So for me, it was back to food, because food was a thing before drugs. And then it was relationships and food, like in this vicious cycle where I'd lose a load of weight by excessive dieting, I'd get into a relationship, I'd gain loads of weight, and realize the relationship was toxic, come out of the relationship, go back into the obsessiveness, then pick up porn, and then pick up money. And it was just in this constant cycle of different things, really.
And how did you get out of that cycle?
I don't know if I did get out of it. I think divine intervention happened, you know, in the form of spiritual realization or awakening and realizing what was really going on. I mean, it's a long journey of facing myself, really. You know, like when you've had traumatic experiences as a child and you've grown up with a level of adversity, the responses of using a substance or a process to cope are actually an intelligence. They actually make sense, because if your level of adversity that you face is too difficult to be with, then your whole psychological maturity is stunted, you know. And it's kind of like, and you're left with reactions of the body, contractions, sensations, discomfort, and obsessive thinking you know, chaotic thinking, self-hatred, self-loathing thinking, you know. And it's like, so using a process or a substance just to feel better is actually just an intelligent part of the mind-body system. So it kind of, you know, it makes sense in that respect to me.
So it's like you're trying to protect yourself because the pain is so severe that because the child part of you has maybe gone through something so horrible that when you're older and you go back into that state as a, like a child and those feelings, emotions come up, it almost feels like death is inevitable. So then the coping mechanism comes in and helps you protect yourself in a way. Would you say that's an accurate description or?
Almost. It's kind of like, you know, what happens... Like, depends, right? First of all, you've got to define adversity and conditioning, you know? It's kind of like, I'm not just talking about, like, my situation was a big event. Then for some people, it might be abuse, might be violence. For other people, it might just be a non-present parent, you know? Like, your parent was never present. They weren't there. They were always working. When you wanted them, they were never there. So there's this longing for love, you know, that stays like the hole in the soul that I talked about. And... then that stuff that happens in childhood becomes part of the subconscious, you know. So we can't actually, it's not actually part of our thinking mind. We don't think, oh, I'm wounded and I have this hole and I have this thing. That's something that we kind of find out later. Usually it just plays out unconsciously. So addiction as a physical compulsion of the body and a mental obsession of the mind, you know, is kind of like, is that coping with that subconscious dis-ease or uncomfortableness of the body and obsessiveness of the mind. It's a way of quietening the mind. It's really easy if you think about this, right? Most people that I ask, they've been sober or clean from drugs and alcohol for a while. They became obsessed or thinking about using drugs again, and they made the decision to go and use. And I say, at what point did you feel better? I say, when I made the decision, I already felt better. There was no drugs or alcohol in my system at that time. So what happens in that moment when we make the decision to go and use is the obsessive thinking of the mind, the compulsion of the body stops. So all that addiction is an innocent attempt to quieten the mind and to soften the contraction of the body, you know, because otherwise we're kind of twisted up and the mind's going round and round and round, use, 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 use. It's kind of like, so the actual action, what we do is stopping the mind and quietening the body, you know. It's like, so it's a different place to look than looking at the actual behaviour, because that's just the coping mechanism, you know.
Mm. So in that moment when you are facing like an urge and that desire and there's like this contraction going on, How can people deal with that?
Yeah, I don't really look there, to be honest, because it's like, I mean, when people come to me or work with addiction, I rarely ever talk about that, you know. It's that is the coping mechanism, that is your mind and body's way, learned way of coping, you know. And sometimes when it comes to that point, you can do whatever you can. You can distract yourself, you can go out running, you can go and hang out with a friend, take yourself off into nature, you can do whatever makes sense to you. But there's just a 50-50 thing in that moment, you know. That's already too late at that point. It's kind of like you're trying to take away the coping mechanism. And it's difficult. Where we have to look is beyond that. Like, why does the coping mechanism need arise in the first place? You know, and that it arises from the internal dis-ease, you know. So looking beyond that, the manifestation, what happens in the behavior and stuff, is like an essential part of recovery, you know. Because if you don't, you will continuously just play that whack-a-mole thing where, even though it seems like you might have stopped for a while, if you haven't really looked at yourself, it's going to come back, you know.
Mm-hmm. I definitely agree with the whack-a-mole idea, because I've experienced that in my own life as well, and we see it with clients where they're trying to quit porn and then they go to food or something instead. I did that for a little while. Basically, yeah. I'd quit the porn for a few months, but then I'd end up eating obscene amounts to try to get rid of that disease, that urge. It would come back, but it would manifest itself in different ways. So with that disease though, not disease, but no, disease, totally dis-ease. Separate things there. With that uneasiness, can that not be caused though by the addiction that's just causing so much like stress and frustration? Like, you just want to quit, and what if you've then done the inner healing and you feel like quite a lot of peace, but then the thing that's holding you back in life from you really kind of fulfilling your full potential is just you still got this addictive habit because the neural pathways are addicted to porn, for example. Can that not then be the thing that you need to work on to get rid of that unease, if that makes sense?
No, I think it's the other way around. Like the internal, the habitual and the neurological pathways come as a result of the disease. So there is a habit-breaking, psychological and physical habit-breaking necessity to quit an addiction. You know, it's kind of like, but trying to, as you might know, trying to will yourself to stop an addiction using self-will is pretty challenging. Yeah. Some people can achieve it. They might take up running instead of pornography, or if they're in a toxic relationship, they might move a town and start a new job or something, which will give you, perhaps the gap that you need just to get your mind and your body in place, you know, doing some inner work on yourself. But the dis-ease comes the other way around, you know, like, so once you break that habit, then you have a chance of kind of looking inwardly. Like if you look in a 12-step workbook, Narcotics Anonymous, it says, we suggest that you stop taking drugs and alcohol before you proceed with this work. Now, I'm not anymore. I was 22 years in 12 steps, but I no longer see that as the only solution to addiction. But it makes sense to me what it says in that book, because you can't really see yourself. You can't really reflect. You can't really have introspection if you're still engaged in a process, you know? So you need to get a little bit of clarity just to give yourself a chance. That's how it looks to me.
So you think it's a lot easier to do the internal work once you've... This is what I'm struggling to understand. So at what point do you think doing the kind of like inner healing work is most useful, whether you've kind of got clean and then you kind of do that work, or do you need to do that work to then get clean?
Well, it's interesting. I think it depends on what the addiction is. If it's drugs and alcohol, I think obviously you need to and you're using every day and you're intoxicated every day, then there's very little chance that you're going to see or hear or do something. Unless you have a real epiphany, you know, something happens, something like a spiritual awakening that happens, can happen momentarily. But when I work with people with process addictions, I don't ask them to stop. You know, I wait for them to stop, and they stop themselves when it makes sense to them, because it's different. Because if I'm asking somebody to stop, I'm taking away their coping mechanisms before equipping them with an understanding of themselves and a way to cope with what's going to happen when they stop the coping mechanism. So what I do is I work with them to help them understand themselves, to see deeply what's going on. If there's something that's some sort of form of suffering or something that's internal, some internalized childhood beliefs and ideas and so on, help them see the futility of all that, you know, and their thing. And then at some point they just go, oh yeah, I don't want to do that anymore. So they don't have that desire, that longing, that craving for something outside themselves to feel better. You know, they don't need it, because I always say no one's ever woken up joyful and happy and great, looked out the window and thought, yeah, I think I'll use crack cocaine today.
Yeah.
No one does that, you know?
Yeah. And it's the same with a lot of these substances as well, is that when you really escape kind of addiction, or you set yourself free, you look back on the addiction, and this is what my mentor said to me, is like, it kind of gets to a place where it's a bit like looking back on like a past relationship or girlfriend, where you're just like, what was I doing with her, you know? That makes no sense anymore. So you look at it in a complete different light. So you said there about the internal beliefs, and they can be carried throughout adulthood, that you like picked up when you were younger. Is there any in your work that you have said that you would say are particularly like prevalent when it comes to addiction? Is there any like kind of theme, or do you think it varies a lot?
There's quite often core. Well, when I say beliefs, I'm just gonna like simplify that. It's just a thought.
Yeah.
A belief is just a thought, you know. So it's kind of like, but it's a position you might have taken on based on the reflection or the lack of reflection of what you got from your primary caregivers, that are very much become habitual and practiced over a lifetime, you know. So it could be the biggest one, I guess, is unworthiness, you know, like, I'm not worthy, I'm not good enough. And most people in their conscious mind will say, yeah, of course I'm good enough, you know. It's kind of like, you know, I feel good, I've done good in my life and stuff. But like that core idea about self that was somehow reflected back to them through this lack of presence or lack of love or toxic or whatever happened in their childhood, you know, it's kind of like, or just even something really simple like a lack of presence or lack of love or something like that, or the odd criticism from a parent. This is not about parent blaming, it's just about seeing how easy it is when you're in the what I call the absorption phase of childhood, where you're absorbing everything around you and making it mean something about yourself. You know, it's like, so when that idea of unworthiness becomes I don't want to make it sound like something bigger than it is. In a way, it becomes ingrained because it's kind of unconscious. You can't see it. And only 5% of the mind is conscious. 95% is completely unconscious. So you might only feel it in a contraction, you know, in like a bodily trigger or reaction to something that you're faced with as a stimulus in the outside world, you know. So I think that's the biggest one. Unworthiness, unlovable, you know, it's kind of like they show up and they quite often, actually, if you look really into someone's life when they have a willingness to look honestly at themselves, you'll find that it runs throughout everything, the job that they do, the relationship that they have, where they live, the relationships with friends. It will be playing out in all those areas, you know.
Mm. How do you help people overcome those feelings of unworthiness?
Well, I think there's two parts to it. The spiritual, psychological, somatic, even, like you could call it three parts. You know, it's like that. One is it's just a thought. That's it. You know, and it's kind of like when you see that, that's a kind of spiritual realization, because the next question is naturally, well, if I'm not this unworthy person, then who am I? You know, and that's a very spiritual question. Who am I? I'm beyond the totality of my ideas about myself, you know. That's the spiritual truth. The psychological part is where it plays out in your life, and the somatic might be, if it's somewhat unconscious, where it just shows up as a contraction, you know. So a lot of my work these days will be somatic, so we just do investigations of the body, you know, like when I'm with this person, I just feel tight, or I feel tension in my neck or something, and it's kind of like these tensions, these tightness will be calling you to look at them, really, because they're kind of saying that there's a feeling of unworthiness going on here, and that just shows up as a tension because it's a subconscious thing. So the spiritual realization is a massive part. It's really important to look beyond the I that I think I am, so to speak. You know, it's like this is the, we could say it's a spectrum, right? And on one end of the spectrum is I'm suffering with addiction, and on the other end of this spectrum, I'm realizing that I'm not who I think I am, you know. And that is a pure awakening realization that I'm playing this character in my own life that I think I am, that's been installed into me as a conditioning and a programming, and none of it is true. Now that's the other end of the spectrum, and everything, the somatics, the psychological, is somewhere in between on that spectrum, you know.
And you said you've been to quite a lot of like 12-step programs. In 12-step, are you told like you are an addict or something? Is that right? So how does that work in terms of the spectrum? Yeah,
you're not supposed to be told that, but people do that. You know, it's kind of like, that's not like, see, the thing with the 12 steps is that Bill Wilson had a spiritual awakening as a result of psychedelics, his work, is all the stuff that he did on investigations, and he wrote down what you could call the recipe, like, of the 12 steps. Now, over 100 years, you know, the method, imagine if you've got a cake, right, you've got a recipe and you've got a method. Over 100 years, I don't know, let's say 1 billion people in 50 different countries have adjusted the method. You know, it's kind of like, so you've got everyone's interpretation of what's actually going on there. What does it mean to have a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps? What does it mean you're powerless? What do all these things mean? So realistically, no one's to tell you, you know, anything. You to decide for yourself. It's self-diagnosed, but people do because they just love to do that, you know?
Yeah. And do you think that helps at all? Like, for you, did 12 steps help?
Yeah, I don't want to make it bad, you know? It's kind of like, I see it as like a stop on the journey, you know. For some people, and many friends of mine, and for me at the time, it was life-saving. Mm. You know, so you can never say that's a bad thing, and that was a beautiful, put me in a position where I was able to look more deeply into myself. Now, it's good at that point, and then the realization is that, the important realization for me is that at some point, that good becomes a limitation. You know, it's kind of like, so it stops you from growing because you've adopted a belief about yourself, i.e. I am an addict, that's not true, because that limitation is a self-imposed limitation. You are not born an addict. In fact, you were born perfectly okay, and everything that's happened since then was a program conditioning that was installed into you. So now, at some point, a lot of this stuff is in my book, you know. It's like that is about getting to that point of realization where you say, okay, I don't really feel like this is benefiting me anymore. I feel like, you know, there's actually something limiting me here rather than benefiting me. And I think that's where a lot of people struggle, because they just stay there for life, you know?
Yeah, yeah. So it's kind of like you get to one level where you're sort of okay, and that will really help you for maybe getting from like level zero, let's say, where you're really like stuck in addiction, and then you get to like level one where you feel like you're quite comfortable with addiction. But then there's kind of another level beyond that, which is where you're ascending this identity of being an addict.
Yeah, I think the 12 steps is trying to point you to a lot of this stuff. It says God is within you, you know, it's kind of like higher power. It talks about all these words that they use are really just trying to point to the spiritual truth of who you are. Like that question when I said, who am I? You know, it's kind of like, then I'm not all these ideas that I've created. I'm not all this stuff that's been installed into me. I'm not my name. I'm not my age. I'm not my job title. I'm not my sibling status or my parental status. I'm not any of these things. And what's left? You know, after that, what is left? And it's like, it can't be true that I am an addict and that is my limit, you know, and I have to do these things to be okay. Actually, I'm already okay. And that's the realization. I don't need to do this to be okay. I'm already okay, you know?
Mm. And do you think your work then helping people like overcome some of the self-limiting beliefs and the conditioning and programming that's been going on for so many years, that is what helps them understand that actually they're okay and they are enough and they are worthy and they don't actually need an external substance to feel okay?
I think this is an interesting point to look at, you know. How do you become not okay? Like, this is the question, right? How do you become not okay? And do you... So, are we not okay and we need to do something to be okay? Or are we already okay and we take ourselves away from being okay? You know, that's an interesting discernment to make, because actually, as I see it, we're already okay and we take ourselves away from that with our belief in not being, right? So, once you undo that, what's like... My work as well, I feel like, is different to most of the therapeutic community and the psychiatric approach, because I'm seeing that people are okay and I'm helping them see that they're okay. Most of the other people are installing something like a pathology, i.e. this is what's wrong with you, here's what you need to do to fix it. I'm not doing that. What I'm doing is helping people see that that's not true. So I'm often undoing a lot of the shit that's been done by other people before me. And actually, as I see it, your default state is happiness and contentment. And you can take yourself away from that all day long, you know, using your mind, your thinking mind, and the installations, the programming, the conditioning, and what's been told to you by other therapists and psychiatrists and so on. You can take yourself away from your default state. So I'm not really doing anything. I'm undoing stuff and helping people to rest in that which they already are, you know, which is very different, I think, to what a lot of other people are doing.
But when it comes to addiction, if someone is addicted and they're stuck in that cycle, would you still say they are okay in that moment? Or would you say that they need to, you know, get out of this cycle of addiction to basically really sort of be okay?
Well, I help them see that what they're doing is intelligence. You know, it's kind of like nobody needs another, what I call, post-it note to stick on them, addict, faulty, broken, because we've got so many of our own. It's kind of like, so when you're going to someone to help you, what do you really need that's going to help you see more? It's kind of like, because I can't stop somebody from using right now if that's what they're going to do. You know, I know that. It's kind of like, but what I can help them to see is, like, what's happening in them is an intelligence. And quite often people will say to me, oh, you're the first person that's said to me I'm not broken. You know, it's kind of like, and then people really take, that's big, you know. It's like, imagine if every professional you went to for all your life told you there's something wrong with you and you need to fix it. You know, it's kind of like, then it's so deflating for people, and actually counterproductive in a way, because those new labels, you can't find a solution that way. You know, you can just find an endless... vicious cycle of like diagnosis or pathology after pathology after pathology that leads you further into depression and lower states of mind. You know, it's like, but when you start pointing out to somebody the intelligence of what's going on in them, they say, well, hold on a minute. Because what I wrote in the start of my book is, this book is not about what's wrong with you. This book is about what's right with you.
Yeah, you know.
So it's helping people see the good in them, because that's what sometimes what people need when they've always been pointed out what's wrong with them, you know?
Yeah, yeah. I've been saying this for quite a while, really, is that if you're struggling with a porn addiction, there's absolutely nothing wrong with you. This is what I always say, is that it's not that there's anything wrong with you, but there may be something wrong with your system or process for trying to quit, because I do believe that there's so much terrible advice out there. I think like 99% of advice on addiction is pretty poor. Maybe not 99%, but like for me anyway, I was basically trying to quit for 9 years and I consumed all the content that's out there on addiction. And it didn't lead me anywhere. I just got really lucky that I was doing one of these podcasts one day and my guest seemed to be like really good on addiction. She'd like worked in it for like over 30 years as well. And she gave me some help afterwards. And then I really realized that actually like this is a choice. Like I can continue to engage in this behavior. I don't need to quit. Mm. And that in a way taught me that actually, yeah, there's nothing really wrong with me. Every day I have a choice. I don't really need to change who I fundamentally am in any way. All I need to do is realize that that choice is always there. It's always an option, but actually how's it really impacting my life, and actually look at that in a more rational way using logic and realizing that, well, at the moment porn is giving me this and this, and it's limiting me from receiving this and this. Actually, I don't really need this anymore. And then since that day, I've just chosen each time I have an urge, because I still feel the urges now and then. But every time I just go through my two lists and make that decision based on logic and what I actually really want. And that's why I've been doing things so far. I wonder if you have any thoughts on that method.
Well, I don't, if anything's working for you, I don't have any opinion. You know, I just say do what feels good. Follow your own wisdom is like the most important thing that I've heard and said myself. You know, it's kind of like that. As I see it, my job is not to help people. My job is to help people see that they can help themselves, you know? And it's like, that's a different position to be in, because I think most people, innocently, I don't think there's anyone malicious in the in the helping professions, you know? I think there's this innocent misunderstanding that goes on, that you think that the therapist helps the client, you know? It's kind of like, and that is just really about ego. That's nothing to do with helping people, because I don't know what's right for anyone else. You know, it's kind of like, but what I do know is I can help people know what's right for themselves, you know, by getting underneath and uncovering some of that stuff that they've took on that's not true, you know. And that's why I call my work sometimes transformative conversations, because we just have conversations about what looks true and what isn't. And I question things that people think look true, and they see beyond the beliefs. You know, that's how, when you asked earlier about getting beyond a belief, sometimes it just takes the right question in the right moment for someone to go, yeah, I've thought about that my whole life. How come I think that? Where did that come from? It's kind of like, and realizing that these beliefs that we have that hold us back, they're not ours. We weren't born with them. They've been installed, you know. Yeah. It's kind of like, and I don't know, people have many stories. I'm not very good at this. I'm not very good at that. I'm not a people person. I'm not social. I'm not this. They're just all stories, you know. And it's like helping people to, the story is based on a belief, you know. So helping people see that these beliefs that they have about self are really just restrictive, you know, but they're self-limiting, you know. They're not something they were born with, and they're not inherent, you know, and they're not essential part of their being. And everyone is powerful and able and creative, you know, and we just veil that with us, all the conditioning that happens.
Yeah, absolutely. Something that I really, really benefited from over the last 12 months has been meditation and Headspace, because Andy on Headspace talks a lot about storylines and how you have all these storylines in your head. And it's like, it's so true, because whenever I have some sort of challenging thought that isn't actually helping me in any way in my life, I can kind of now see it as, oh, it's just another storyline. It's just another thought, a belief that has evolved over time, I suppose, just in my mind, and it doesn't really add anything to my life. And so to see that for what it is has been pretty game changing. And I think it's something I still want to work on a lot further. So when it comes to storylines, would you say there's any like techniques or ways in which people can help really like see that these are just like thoughts which have been conditioned into them over time?
Yeah, I think, I mean, like, I was in a spiritual understanding called the Three Principles, you know, there's a big emphasis on thought, and really the role of thought in our own narrative, you know, it's the, what you're talking about, you know. And it's actually like helping people see that thought is nothing. It's just an energy that passes through us, a transient energy. Like if we took a snapshot of yours or my thoughts over a 30-minute period, there would be something that could get you locked up, something you wouldn't want to tell anyone, something about next week, something about last week, something completely random and obscure. You know, it's kind of like, now everyone's would have that same transient, random snapshot. You know, it's kind of like, so the noise of your mind, you know, it's not really that useful or relevant, you know, is what I learned in that time. And it's kind of like actually seeing that you can just turn the volume down by realizing that I'm living in the story of my own mind, in the story of my own narrative. And like, and actually I am part of that narrative. Like that's when we transition back to that spiritual question, who am I? Because kind of like, I'm not my thoughts. I'm not the story of me. I'm not who I think I am. I'm not who I believe I am. You know, it's kind of like, I'm not all these labels that I've attached to myself and what's left after that. Because that gets rid of the value of all the thinking that I have. Because if you think about the narrative, like when we're having self-based thinking, it's always, I'm always the central subject of those thoughts. I've not got this, I've not got that, I need this, I need that, I need to fix this, I need to do this, I need to do that, I need to get here, I need to get there, when I get this I'll be okay, when I get that I'll be, it's always me, you know. It's not like, oh, how can I help this person, I'm always the, that. And it's just seeing that the futility of that, and that actually that most people believe their thoughts are their life. That's their life and that's where they live, in their head, you know. So it's like getting out of your head and get into your heart, you know. It's kind of like, it's a real, just notice when everything you're thinking about is centered around yourself. Get out of your head, go and do something, go for a walk in nature, go and help somebody, you know. It's like, get out and feel into your body. Because another byproduct of having addictions is that we learn to live in our heads, and everything is thought-based when you live in the head. So when I first work with somebody, I say like, what's going on here? You know, it's kind of like everything happened. Well, what do you feel this? Where do you feel here? Everything happens here. Like, there's nothing else. And I'm like, well, what happens below here? What happens when you become reconnected to your body and you start to feel your feelings again? Because you've shut off from them as a way of coping, you know? It's like there's too much uncomfortableness. So all that stuff is highly relevant in my work, seeing that what is there beyond the story of me, you know?
Mm. Yeah, there's been times before where I've tried to get rid of some of the urges that I'm experiencing to engage in looking at porn, and I've like gone on a walk, but I've just been so totally not present on that walk. I've just been like in my head, just going round and round and round, just thinking. And then I just come home and I remember just like going and engaging in that act anyway. It's like I went for the walk to distract myself for a bit, more and more thinking, and then I just go engage. It's like distracting yourself by just thinking more and more and trying to think your way out of addiction on your own, I think, can be really, really challenging. I think sometimes you do need a bit of help and to go talk to someone. At least for me, I did anyway.
It's true. You can't use thought to overcome thought. You know, it's kind of like, it's like, I imagine, like, if I draw it on a diagram, it's like a picture with a bubble around their head with thought, and then judgment of thought, you know, why am I having these thoughts? Yeah. Why haven't I got over this now? I should be finished with this by now. I've been doing this long enough. And then kind of like, oh my God, what am I going to do? It's going to go on forever. And then it's going bigger and bigger and bigger because we're using the very mind. I mean, Einstein's quote was something like, you can't escape the creation of the problem at the same level of thinking that you use to create it. You know, it's going to, you need to get out of your head, you know. It's like, so once you're in that place, sometimes, like you said, you become, all you need in that moment is to notice. If you notice, oh, I'm not present, things disappear. You know, your mind will quieten for a moment. It's like, but when you're locked in, sometimes I would describe it like a washing machine. It's like looking at all the clothes in a washing machine going around and trying to work out what's in there. You can't do that. You have to open the door and take everything out and see. And that's your speaking to somebody, being with someone, listening to something, some meditation or some talk or something like that, whatever's useful. Or even distraction, if distraction works for you. Like in your case, in that moment, it didn't. Some people, being by the sea, speaking to a certain person, some form of distraction will just give you that time for your mind to quieten down, you know?
Mm. It's interesting that you use that analogy of the washing machine, because we got taught that as well in our Samaritans training, because we were told that, look, you're going to have people call you up with some kind of, well, you're going to have all kinds of issues, which we do. Like, yeah, people have horrible life circumstances all the time, and they're called up, they'll be telling us about their problem. And this is the thing, is that, yeah, when they've got these problems, like, as a as the listener, we can't solve those problems. Like the washing is staying the same, like the clothes are staying the same, but instead of it being jumbled around in a washing machine going around at 100 miles an hour, they've now had the time and space to be heard and listened to so that they can actually like put that washing out. And it's a bit like, okay, so the clothes are still wet, that's all right, but at least now they're a bit more organized and they're not going around at like a crazy pace, right? So that can really help.
Sometimes just distracting people, you know, sometimes I just don't want people to talk about their problems, you know, because it's like the more, if you notice, if you start spilling out your, what you think your problems are, because problems, as somebody sees it, are really just about their perspective of it and not necessarily about the truth of it, you know, it's kind of like, everyone's got that perspective of where things look like a problem. And like what allows them to see it differently, to change their perspective, is just distracting them for a while. Get them to talk about something different. What's good in your life? You know, have you got a dog? Have you got a cat? Oh, yeah, I've got a dog. How do you like walking a dog? And it's like, before you know it, they're kind of like relaxing a little bit and they start to go, yeah, you know that thing? It doesn't look just quite the same from this place, you know, because they're looking at it from a different feeling state. And sometimes when they go more into the problem, it's kind of like they just get more and more agitated. Have you noticed like a best example of that is kind of like going to bed like overwhelmed with something. You wake up in the morning and you get in the shower and you just think, shit, now I know what to do. Well, what happened in the night was I stopped thinking about it, my mind quieted down, and I got just this much space to allow fresh thinking, insight, you know, which can come through any of us at any time, realization of something different, a new opportunity, a new perspective, as a space to come through.
Yeah, absolutely. And like from a more neuroscientific perspective as well, it makes total sense, because I think when you're like really stressed out, you can have different sort of things going on in the brain where like the prefrontal cortex may not be quite as active, and so like the rational part of the brain may not even be engaged. And so you're trying to solve a problem when your brain's not really at its optimal time to solve the problem. Like sometimes you just take a minute, just do something else for a little while, you come back to the problem and you might be able to solve it. I think with addiction, like for me personally, like, yeah, distracting myself has only ever led to temporary freedom from porn. And so it worked for like a few weeks, and maybe that's what I needed at the time. Maybe that helped. So I used to do a lot of these things called a nofap streak. It's basically where you go without porn for like a certain amount of days. And it's quite a big like community online. I don't know, have you heard of it before?
No, not at all.
Yeah, so it's, yeah, it's all about basically quitting porn and kind of quitting masturbation, but I think the focus is more on porn. And so I'd do these nofap streaks, get to like X amount of days, and then I'd go and have a relapse. But what would happen for me in the past is I was always focusing on removing the trigger, which would be maybe like deleting social media or YouTube and getting rid of the things that would cause me to feel the urge and the desire. But then it never really worked, because I'd always end up going back and having a relapse, because I hadn't actually realized that like this is a choice. I'm not deprived of anything. Like I can engage in that if I want to. But what I was doing by removing all the triggers is really depriving myself of the opportunity to look at that content. And I was just ingraining in my mind this like belief and idea that I can't look at it, when what I've now realized is that the reality is I can look at it, and that's okay, that I want to look at it now and then as well. But it's about making a choice that actually is going to serve me. So yeah,
I think perhaps something that came to mind that we haven't quite looked at is that really, you know, like in the true spiritual sense, nothing outside of us is happening. It's everything is happening inside. Like life is happening from the inside out, not from the outside in. So when it looks like some behavior outside of us is a problem, it can't possibly be true. It's only a projection. You know, it can only be a projection of the mind onto a behavior. So like all my dis-ease exists within me. You know, it can't be someone else. For example, if I say, oh, this person spoke to me a certain way, it made me feel that. No, that's not true. You know, it's kind of like what's true is like that's inside of me. Everything that's happening is inside of me. So the opportunity of life is to heal what's going on inside. So when it looks like there's this thing, you know, it's kind of like as a problem, really is just an attempt to soothe, you know, to find ease within ourselves. And the truth is that nothing is ever happening outside of us. Everything is happening inside of the mind. Like Viktor Frankl in the book, Man Searcheth for Meaning, you know, there's a quote in there that says, between stimulus and response, you know, is the opportunity for that. And so it's like what he's saying is that nothing is as it seems. Nothing, never. You know, 100% of the time, we're creating our perspective of this so-called objective world, you know, that lives outside of us. And like some people will say, Joe Dispenza says, like, the objective world is 99.999% energy and 0.001% matter. You know, it's kind of like, so everything is just appearing as it looks to us within our own conditioning. You know, it's like, so this is really important when it comes to addiction, because there's this underneath, beyond the symptom, which is, you know, the excessive use of pornography in this case, or drugs or alcohol or whatever it is, like beyond that, looking at the symptom, looking back, it's kind of like, then what is really going on in this case? You know, it's kind of like, is that I'm looking to heal myself, you know, I'm looking to find like myself in an external world that doesn't really exist, you know, and nothing can ever be resolved at that place. So the appearance of energy to us as an objective world, you know, is just basically based on our conditioning and our own mind, which is quite far out, really. It's a bit of a it's a difficult concept for the mind to grasp. You know, what do you mean the objective world doesn't even exist? There's no real things and that. Well, there isn't, you know. It's kind of like no one ever experiences anything but perception. You know, we can't experience anything but perception. We experience perception via the thought of our own mind, which is through the filter of our conditioning. The easiest way to say it is I'm wearing yellow glasses and I didn't know, you know, everything looks yellow. You know, and they can be just taken off, the glasses, if you understand and see that life is happening inside of me and not outside of me. And that's why, to me, there's no shame around pornography. I know there's a stigmatized and a shame and so on that goes on in the objective world and around.
I was just about to go on to say this as well.
I wanted to say it, but I think it's important. So yeah, I use porn, so what? Like, when you're okay with it, you can't have any shame about it. It's just when other people say it, you feel the shame you feel about yourself. You know, it's not really coming from other people, even if other people are critical or they've got judgment of it. So, but this is the deep realization is that everything's happening within me and not outside of me. So anything I feel based on what looks like the outside is a projection and is not really coming to me from that. Does that make sense?
Yeah. So it's quite interesting because, so my mentor, Mary, she talks about her basically like methodologies called beyond compulsion. And so it's all about compulsion. It's not actually about the symptom of like whether it's food, whether it's drugs, whether it's alcohol, whether it's porn. She doesn't care at all. She just thinks like it's essentially going to be the same thing, because it's about, yeah, it is really about not being able to deal, not being willing to deal with certain discomfort. And that's what she says, is that, you know, people have a choice. You can choose this route or you can choose that route, but often they're going to choose the route of the addictive substance if they're not willing to face the discomfort in that moment, the temporary discomfort. And yeah, she was talking to me the other day and she was saying, you know, this porn stuff, like, do you not want to open up our sort of services, our offer, our help to people with any addiction? Because it doesn't really make a difference. Like, the program itself, actually, like, once you're in the program, the video series, it doesn't really talk much about porn addiction. It just talks about addiction in general. And it's working really well for the people who are sort of doing it at the moment. And that's the thing, is that when you're in this porn addiction, you can have so much like shame and think that like porn is the problem, and that it's to do with porn and to do with like maybe some sexuality or like your sexual taste and stuff. But really, porn addiction has very, very little to do with sexuality or sexual taste or anything like that. It's really to do with what's going on internally in the mind, as you say. And that extra layer of shame is like on top of these feelings of failure or unworthiness. I mean, that's what I used to experience, is, you know, it probably started off with the root cause being like, yeah, feelings of failure, feelings of unworthiness, maybe related to like not being able to help my mum enough when I was younger or something like this. And then, you know, you go escape that and you look at porn, and then you have this another feeling and it's like, oh God, like, why have I done that? I feel terrible. And you've got another layer on top of that. But actually at the root, it's that original discomfort of feeling like a failure or feeling unworthy. And that's what causes the problem. The porn is the symptom. It's the symptom of an unwillingness to feel discomfort temporarily. And in addiction, you you want to get away from the discomfort, and so you just keep going round and round. But then the addiction, in my opinion, starts to create more discomfort, and so that becomes really, really difficult to then escape. But it's 100% possible as well. And as we've said, it's like there's literally nothing wrong with somebody for struggling with addiction. It doesn't mean there's anything wrong with them. It doesn't mean that they have, like, I don't know, some kind of weird over sexual desire. Like, that's another thing I used to have. So when I was at school, I remember being one of the first guys to maybe start, like, masturbating and stuff, and I used to think, like, maybe there was something a bit wrong with me for kind of being a bit too into all of that at, like, such a young age. But now when I look back, it's like, no, there was, like, literally nothing wrong with me. But that was just a belief, a thought that I'd taken on and kind of carried throughout the next, like, 10 years of my life or whatever.
Yeah, I think it's important points to make. I like what you said about the shame cycle, you know. It's like, because it's like I said about the growing thought bubble around the head, you know. It's kind of like the judgment and the shame of what I've just done will create more feelings that I want to escape from, which will end up into that vicious cycle and so on and stuff like that, you know. But it's to realize that the only judgment that's possible is what I said earlier, is of myself, you know. It's, even though it's a social and societal conditioning that's installed in us, you know, like whatever your parents' belief about sex and so on, or whatever you was taught at school or in your young age, or this is shameful. Let's say your parents hid it from you completely. It's kind of like, you don't talk about that. We don't watch it on the telly. Oh, cover your eyes when something comes on, you know. It's kind of like, so you learn these beliefs and ideas. Oh, that's something that, you know, you shouldn't do, you shouldn't see, you shouldn't talk about. And then, you know, it's like finally maybe you admit it to the wrong person and they're like, oh, you're fucking disgusting, why are you doing that? You know, it's kind of like you get that bad response from somebody who really doesn't understand also. So then you further internalize the shame, you know, and the ideas, and it's like it just constantly creating this vicious cycle. But just to realize that that's within, it's not outside. You're not feeling the pressure of a society, of people, of anyone else's judgment. You're feeling your own judgment, your own guilt, your own shame that's happening within you, which is again a belief that I shouldn't be doing this, you know. And that's, you can free yourself from that, you know. You can completely free yourself from it. It's like I have people that I work with that will come back to me and say, yeah, I relapsed, you know. And it's like, there's a chapter in my book about is abstinence a goal for, I can't remember the exact chapter, but the name, but is abstinence a goal for recovery? Like, so we're talking about the same thing here. Is abstinence from porn or drugs or alcohol the goal? No, it's not the goal. You know, the goal is peace of mind. It's kind of like if you, there's a story in there, and it came from somebody that was on a podcast of mine years ago. He said, like, if you've worked at the same job for years and years and years, and then you get a new job, and he says, you're driving to work to the new job, and you just take a wrong turning, does that mean you still work at the old job? No, it just means you took a wrong turning. And that's the same, right? Same thing that happens if you've had a life of addiction and you've now become abstinent, and it's kind of like, and you relapse, so to speak. You know, I don't even like the word relapse. You slip or whatever, you go back to your old behavior because something got too much for you. Does that mean you're now still back in it? No, it happened, and it's cool because things like that happen. Sometimes we just take a wrong turn. Abstinence is not the goal of recovery. Peace of mind is the goal of recovery. If you have peace of mind, you have abstinence. If you have abstinence, you don't necessarily have peace of mind, because you can will yourself to be abstinent, but it can be very painful and difficult. You know, it's kind of like, so it has to work the other way around.
Yeah, I've got 2 points to say on that. So we'll start off with the abstinence and peace of mind, because the first thing on that is I would say for like so many years, I would abstain from porn, and I'd do an okay job at that, and I'd do these like nofap streaks, as I say, but I did not have the peace of mind which I was seeking for. I felt very confident at times, I felt in control at times, and then I'd end up having a relapse anyway, or a slip up, and I'd feel pretty terrible again. And I hadn't really understood that actually this is a choice. I was using willpower essentially. I was resisting, I was distracting, and I didn't have that peace of mind because I was using these ineffective strategies. And so in terms of peace of mind, I mean, you can abstain from the addictive substance that you're trying to abstain from without peace of mind, is what I'm getting at there. And I think that's what a lot of people do. The second thing I would say, though, is that when it comes to relapsing, and I'm just kind of repeating what I think Mary would say, because I really trust Mary. She's the one who's helped me quit. She would say, I think if you tell an addict that relapses are sort of okay, like maybe they're part of recovery and that it's okay to kind of go down that route, then what if they're just going to like kind of use that as ammunition in a way to go, okay, well, you know what, it's okay, I can have a relapse now and then.
Yeah. I differentiate between kind of like the craziness in early recovery of that, you know, it's kind of like, because the truth is that I can't tell you, but you know the difference between those two things. If you honestly ask yourself, like, I'm just, this is okay just to do this. Is it really okay? No, it's not. It's not going to be okay within you, you know, and everything is about the relationship that you get with yourself, because this is why I said I can't help anyone, but I help anyone to get a better relationship with themselves. And to me, it's the difference between traditional therapy and psychiatric approach, which is a plaster on a bullet hole, versus something that's going to last you a lifetime, the relationship with yourself, where you can discern the difference between I'm just using an excuse here to escape myself, or actually, I'm okay. Because the truth is that some people can watch porn normally, afterwards, you know, it's kind of, and there's nothing wrong with that. I have no judgment whatsoever. Yeah. If whatever you choose to do is whatever you choose to do. I don't. It doesn't interest me. But I have no opinion on whether you should or shouldn't. And I have no opinion on whether people should or shouldn't drink alcohol or smoke cannabis or take drugs. You know, and having worked with people for so long, like probably 25 years with addiction, I see that some people can't. And some people can. And I don't. I mean, I'm abstinent, like, from that, because I just choose that. It makes sense to me. But I lived a life of extreme chaos, you know, of prisons and institutions and psychiatric sectioning and so on. So to me, all that chaos stuff has not been part of my life for a long time. And it doesn't feel like a good idea. And I'm not really sure. I don't really feel like it would be appealing to me. But other people who had identified themselves as having some sort of issue and have now got to a place where their life is quite peaceful and joyful, and they just want to do it every now and again, and then they forget about it. That's cool. And that's why I said I don't know what's best for everyone, but people know what's best for themselves. So that might be a part of the journey. See, it's not for me. I'm not justifying it for somebody to do it. What I'm creating the space for is somebody to learn who they are.
Yeah,
you know. And in that process, it might take a few times of somebody going, well, yeah, I'm okay doing it, and then going, you know what, I'm not really okay doing it. I'm just cheating myself.
It's about that's being honest important with thing. Yourself, isn't it?
Yeah, it's learning who you are and learning what's true for yourself. And that, the value of that is lifetime, because you get more connected to yourself, more honest with yourself, and more knowing of yourself, you know, versus me giving you a prescriptive solution, you know?
Yeah, yeah, that makes sense. And yeah, I totally agree that the relationship that one has with themselves is the most important. Well, in my opinion, I think it's the most important thing when it comes to quitting addiction. It's quite funny as well, because for like 10 years, I was consuming like so many books, podcasts, and everything I could find out there on how to quit porn. And the best advice I ever received was from my friend who does look at porn, and he doesn't have a problem with porn, as a lot of my friends don't, because, you know, we're guys in our 20s, it doesn't really matter to a lot of people, and that's okay. I don't judge them, I don't care, you know, it's not my problem, it's up to them. And what my friend said is, like, to be honest, it is just all down to your relationship with yourself. So a lot of people ask me as well, like, when do I know whether I'm addicted to porn or not? And for me, it's like, there's not really like a right amount of how much you look at porn, how much you don't. For like the last 5 years, I've looked at porn less than probably any of my friends that I know. And yeah, I probably have more of an issue over the last 5 years with porn than anyone else I know as well. So that's the thing, is it's not about the quantity, it's about your relationship with yourself and your relationship to the behavior, and also how compulsive it can be as well. Because for me, I'd be looking at porn to escape, yeah, as you say, feelings of failure, feelings of unworthiness, feelings of shame, or whatever it was. Whereas other people are looking at porn because they just want to look at porn. You know, they're not trying to escape some gaping hole within their soul. Whereas I was personally, and that's why it was such a problem, because through facing that discomfort in myself, like the next day after doing that, it's just like, I feel so good. I just feel so good through facing the discomfort. And that's like a learned skill that I feel like I now have, which gives me like a really sort of stable foundation in my life where, yeah, like what happens externally now, it can kind of happen. And I know how to deal with that. Whereas I think in the past, if something bad happened externally, I wouldn't know how to deal with it. So I'd have to go and cope by using porn, essentially.
Yeah. Yeah, it makes sense. The deeper the relationship, the more knowing you are of yourself. Sometimes it's subconscious, not necessarily. People's conditioning, like I said, is a large part unconscious. So people will tell me their life's great, but they're still using porn, for example. You know, it's kind of like, so, well, how come? Like, what does that mean? So you need to ask some questions and start to understand. Not their opinion of their life, but what they tell you about what's really happening in their life. Because you'll, as somebody who's been through it, if you ask those questions, you'll start to, they'll tell you things about their relationships, about their work, about their relationship with money and so on and stuff, where it all shows up. So regardless of them saying their life's great, they won't actually see the unconscious stuff playing out. So it's not always about conscious beliefs about self. Quite often there's some unconscious stuff playing out. But I think it's right what you said. The more you get to know yourself, the more you feel okay sitting with self, the more relationship you have with yourself, the less desire or longing there is to escape that which you are. You know, it's like authenticity is an important point of this conversation, because there's a lot with social media. We're exposed to like a lot of these things that people talk about. Authenticity is like a buzzword of the moment, but I don't think people don't really know what authenticity is. You know, what authenticity is showing up as you are, like with all your vulnerability and your shame and everything, and just being willing to share that with somebody. Your authenticity includes your past conditioning, things that happened and didn't happen, and the ideas you made about yourself. You know, it's not once I've got it all worked out, here's what I am now, here's what I used to do. That's not authentic. What's authentic is being willing to be in the moment with what shows up, including all the bits you don't want anyone to know about.
Definitely. And on that point of authenticity, I really think like the world in some way, it will work to help you. The more authentic you are, the more the universe somehow will help you. At least that's what I've experienced over the last few months, because honestly, I was feeling like so frustrated with myself a few months ago. So Andy, who's in the studio right now, he'll know this, but like, I came in here one day and I was like, really wanted to set up like a studio, but I was just down and out. I just had a relapse and that used to really hit me hard, and I was just feeling so upset with myself and frustrated, especially because I had this podcast and I was trying to help people quit porn, and I thought at one point that I'd mastered this because I hit like a really long streak. As I say, like I distracted myself so long that I thought that I've got my stuff together now. Anyway, I hadn't. So I come in here, I'm dead upset. Just had a relapse, and Andy's like, what's the matter? Like, your energy just seems totally different today. And I was like, I just said it straight. And then I did a podcast. I spoke to this woman, Mary, who like really helped me. And she listened to one of my podcasts previously where I'd said like, yeah, I'd had a relapse and stuff. Like, I was quite honest and vulnerable. And I think through that, she actually really did genuinely want to help me. Like, she saw someone who wanted to help other people, but really needed to help himself first. And she gave me coaching and helped me. And since then, like, as I say, I feel like life's just changed completely. And I feel so, so grateful for that. But the other thing to admit is like, I've not been on this journey too long either. You know, I've got so much more to learn. And that's why I'm talking to people like you today, is I've got so much more to learn. And I just think this addiction is so prevalent in so many people's lives, and it can really help a lot of people by talking about it, because there can be a lot of shame around this one, but as we say, it goes a bit deeper than that.
I think like everyone's the wounded healer, you know, in some ways. It's kind of like everyone got into what they, that's what I was saying about trauma and childhood adversity and stuff being at the core of what you do, you know, and where you live and everything. If you look into it, it'll be part of it, you know. It's kind of like the reason you like doing this is because it's helping you too, you know, to understand yourself. And it's the same reason for me why I ended up becoming a therapist, because I really thought if I could just help others, I'm sure I must be able to learn how to help myself. And it was like, you know, even after I had qualifications, I was clueless, you know. It took me a lot more years on my journey of struggling and like trying to ride a bike and falling off, so to speak, you know, before I actually got to a place where I could say, you know, now I'm happy, I'm content, I can say it, you know. It's kind of like, in my book, it talks about being a therapist and secretly having addictions, you know, and me and other therapists that I knew too, you know, that would tell me the truth. And what it says in my book is that people would confide in me as a therapist about their secret addictions, and I would lie about mine. I wouldn't tell them. Mm. You know, it's kind of like, I would keep, oh yeah, okay, because people confided in me. I thought that I couldn't tell them that I really did this first, this too, because they trusted me to share with me because I was trustable. I didn't repeat things, you know. So it's all part of the process, you know. It's kind of like, certainly for me, for many years, I was helping people when I couldn't help myself or I was struggling in the background and feeling, because you feel that, that inauthenticity, you know, that inauthentic feeling, that imposter syndrome kind of feeling. How can I really help people when I don't know? And I describe that as a, as like I could sit in the dark with people, but nobody knew where the light switch was. Didn't know how to help anybody because I couldn't help myself, you know. And when I really find peace within myself, I can point other people to peace, you know.
Yeah, yeah. How long ago was that, that you were doing therapy while still going through addiction a bit?
10 years.
Mm.
Years ago, I was still like that. I'd say it's only in the last 7 or 8 years, since I had a real spiritual realization, which happened about 7 years ago.
How did that play out as well, the spiritual realization?
That's the fundamental biggest change in everything, you know. It's kind of like that absolutely changed everything, turned everything on its head instantaneously, because I had been a therapist and I'd been in the 12 steps and I'd been in, I was qualified in all sorts of different therapies, in NLP, in CBT, in psychodynamic, transactional analysis, in-person-centered therapy. So I thought I knew a thing or two, you know. It's kind of like, yeah, I'm really this great qualified therapist. But really I couldn't help myself still, because every time I did more qualifications, I'd done the Landmark Forum, I'd done the Hoffman process, I'd done silent meditations, I'd done all of Tony Robbins's courses, and it was like, and I was still struggling. You know, it's kind of, in fact, I'd resigned. I'd decided that I'm going to suffer for the rest of my life and I'm just going to become okay with suffering. That was it, because I couldn't find a way out of it. And I coincidentally found this course online called The Path of Effortless Change by Michael Neal. And I was listening to it, not only because I wanted to record it, and I was just thinking, there's something this guy's saying is really interesting, you know. And he was sharing the work of Sydney Banks that I talked about, the three principles. And like, I was really kind of fascinated because it was a very spiritual kind of realization. But I ended up a year later at Michael's house in Los Angeles, you know, for a 2-day, what's called an intensive, but it was very relaxed, you know. And after 2 days there, I just realized, I woke up, I was sat outside and I was looking around and I was thinking, shit, I feel really good. You know, it's kind of like my life, I feel free, you know, I feel home. That was the feeling, I feel home. And it was like, and I think all my lifetime of suffering has come to an end. I kind of knew, you know, it was weird because it all just came apart in 2 days. And I realized that that I was a victim of my own mind. I was not a victim of life, because I told this story of this kid whose dad was killed. He went out, he never came back. And then I got into drugs and crime and prisons and psychiatric interventions and sectioning and locked wards and all this stuff. So I was, you know, like people will tell the story as a victim or a survivor. I'm a survivor of all these things. Well, I was a survivor. I'd been a victim, but I was a survivor at that point. But to say I'm a survivor still means there's a story. You know, and at that point I realized, oh, this stuff happened, but I'm not any of these things. It's not part of me. It happened and it's gone now. And like right now, today, I'm not affected by the story of my own mind, you know. And it was kind of like I'd woken up from a bad dream and I was free. You know, from that point, I was really free. It's like my life changed unrecognizably from that moment. And it was like a deep spiritual realization. And since then, I've been into non-duality and going to different spiritual retreats and stuff and just really meditating and seeing, you know, what is at the core of my being, my essential self, who am I beyond all the stories? And I think the knowing of that now is what informs all my work, you know. It's kind of like knowing that we're all perfectly okay and we just think that we're not, you know, and we get lost in this conditioning, this story of self that's installed from conditioning and childhood, and then we try to escape the narrative that we're creating in our own mind of this suffering being, you know. It's like, but there's something beyond all of that, something beyond all that story, the true self, you know, who we really are, the part that's never damaged, cannot be broken, can't be scratched, can't be faulty, can't be something wrong with it. Everybody has that innately healthy part of them, you know?
Yeah, yeah, definitely. And I think nowadays it's arguably harder than ever to really gain clarity on all of that, because there is so, so many storylines being fed to us, this information just being just like thrown in our face every single day, every minute, if you spend a lot of time on social media, which I think a lot of people do. And so you're just getting all these different storylines, like, you need to do this to do this, you need to do this to do this. And it's just like, it's taken away from the reality that actually you don't really need to do anything to be whole and worthy. You're enough just as you are. And I think that's a big problem with social media and YouTube. I mean, I guess even this podcast, in a sense, it's about, right, you've got to quit porn. But I mean, I'd like to think that we're giving people an option, a choice, and you can quit porn if you'd want, or you can continue to look at porn. It really depends on the listener and what their goals and values are, and not even the values, just what they want to do. But yeah, I mean, there's just so much information out there now, and the more information that you have that's based around you need to do this, the more you're going to internalise some feelings of, I'm not quite right as I am.
Yeah, and that's why I don't tell anyone they need to stop, you know, because I don't want to be another person that thinks he knows best for other people, you know. It's kind of like, and just like when I did some training years ago, they said to me, if it ever feels like you're doing the heavy lifting, then you've missed something, you know. It's kind of like, so really, like, I'm not trying to get anybody anywhere. People need to bring something that they want for themselves, in which case I can help them see what it is in them that's stopping them from achieving it. So that's often the way it comes about. It's like, I've got no agenda for people, you know. And I think that's important to see that, like you said, people are already perfectly okay and they just think that they aren't, you know. And it's just really my job to help them see that they are, and that addiction has been part of their innocent attempt at self-actualization, you know. And that's what you said before. You said life will give us opportunities to find ourselves. I think that's all life is. I don't think there's anything else happening here apart from we're born, we're taken away from ourselves with the stories, conditionings, and the levels of adversity, and then life continuously holds a mirror up for us to come back to our true self and who we are. And everything that's painful or suffering or a struggle is really just saying to us, not here, not here, you know. Redirect yourself, or it's asking you to look inward and heal something within yourself. And it's like, then you get to see the beauty of just being alive, just the beauty in a flower, or just walking in the street, or walking down the side of the canal, or seeing people, or helping somebody across the road, or what, in the nothingness, not in the things, not in the money or the prestige or the status or the weight loss or the trophy girlfriend or boyfriend or whatever it is, you know. It's like, not in that, but just in the beauty of being alive, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. And I've been thinking about this a bit recently, because sometimes I feel like I can still get caught up in my own desires. But I was thinking about desire the other day, and like, I have a few goals, and even with like this podcast, like every time I see like the listeners go up, I'm like, oh yeah, great. But the reality is, like, the more desire that I have in my life, the greater the gap between where I am now and just like feeling whole and worthy and where I want to get to, like some kind of vision for the future. And I suppose dopamine gets really sort of intertwined with all of this, because the world's now set up to just kind of get you keep on going and going more, 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 you know. That's what the world's based on. I mean, dopamine is the molecule of more. So people are kind of fed this idea that you always need to be growing, always need to be developing, always need to be moving towards something new. But in a sense, that's taken away again from this idea, this concept, the truth that you are all right as you are now.
Yeah. I think desire is inherent, like desire for something. But I think, again, it comes back to that discernment of, is this desire about me getting something to make me better, to take me further along this imaginary ladder that doesn't even exist apart from in my own mind? You know, it's like, is my perception of myself going to increase through this desire? Like, for just use a basic example, I get a faster car or a bigger house, you know. I've got 4 bedrooms, I need 5. I've got a Porsche, I need a Ferrari, whatever, something along that lines. You can see that that is like coming from a place of lack, you know. It's kind of like, it's fueled, that desire is fueled by a place of lack. But the desire to help people, just to share something with the world, you know, it's kind of like, that's a beautiful thing. Just an inherent desire to you know, because you're not never going to be desireless. You know, desire is to be alive, you know, to have some desire to be with people, just to see people wake up, for me, is beautiful. To see people not suffer anymore is beautiful, you know. It's like, because if you judged all desire, you just sit in a box somewhere and do nothing or something for the rest of your life. You know, there's not much left after that. You know?
No, that's a really good point. That's really, really interesting to me, because sometimes I've judged and questioned my own desire. But if my if I'm going to have desire either way, like if desire is something that is inherent within all, which it probably is, yeah, so I may as well direct that desire towards doing something that's going to positively impact the world and make the most of that desire in the right way, instead of using that desire to go and engage in porn or something that just is an absolute waste of time, in my opinion, personally, for me. So that's really good to reframe that way of thinking. As I say, I've got so much to learn, so thank you again for coming on the podcast. Where can people find you and your book as well?
My book is called The Infinite Recovery Project. It's going to be released soon. It's in its final edits and design, and it's really just a way of finding your true self from addiction, through addiction or mental health, you know, struggles. So it's it'll be on Amazon at some point soon. There is a website, infiniterecoveryproject.com. It'll be on there. Or my website, wideworldcoaching.com. You can find me there. There's loads of different interviews and things and stuff on there.
Awesome. All right. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast, Jason.
No worries.
Thanks for listening or watching. And I hope you have an amazing rest of your day.